vaccination campaign in France seems to be successful, but they would like the French government to use the method of persuasion rather than a restriction. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A scene of desperation transformed into one of horror in the waning days of the U.S.-led occupation. Two terrorist attacks on Kabul airport, claimed by Daesh. Dozens killed, among them children and U.S. troops. Hundreds more injured. British troops were spared this time. The U.K. Prime Minister says he's sticking to the evacuation plans.
The military, the Foreign Office teams, the Home Office, the Border Force teams are there getting people through as fast as they can still. And we're going to keep going up until the last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated. And the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext, which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but there are resourceful, ingenious people who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Pariza, London.
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban's offer to run the airport, assuring that it is very important to keep the airport functioning to help receive aid supplies. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
in the limelight.
The founding of two North American neighboring countries, Canada and the U.S., has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems, says Siku Alulu, writer, in an article published under the heading, Canada's Indigenous Genocide is Ongoing. Stay tuned for more. The recovery of mass and unmarked graves at former Indian residential school sites in recent weeks has released a deluge of outrage and grief across the settler colony known as Canada. Horrifying truths are being unearthed that reveal the treachery by which Canadian governments, churches, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, originally stole and continue to steal indigenous lands. We say recoveries because these are not new discoveries. This particular form of genocide unleashed against indigenous children has been aggressively instituted and actively concealed by Canadian governments, churches, and RCMP since 1831, when the first residential school was established in Brantford, Ontario. Genocide here is defined both as murders of children and criminal acts of negligence and mistreatment that caused deaths that could have been prevented if authorities had acted on the concerns that were repeatedly brought to government. The high death rates, inhospitable conditions, and preventable causes of death were known. It was not secret, even beyond the stories from survivors and all we heard during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, states Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson, referring to a national commission that took place in 2008 in a recent social media post. It was known by the government, known by the churches, and to some degree, known by the Canadian public. We cannot pretend this is a revelation. That would also be hiding the truth. This is a reckoning of generations of criminal wrongdoing and widespread complicity in this brutal system, unquote. None of what we say here is news. Rather, it is the culmination of urgent messages that Indigenous peoples have been shouting for years across the country and the globe in myriad ways, in perpetuity. I find myself frustrated with words at this point. Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott tells people because they so often take the place of action in this country. These are recoveries of people's loved ones who never made it home. The truth that were always suppressed and denied. The anguish that makes sense of their lives and compounded righteous rage. It is fitting that the national holidays of Canada Day and Independence Day in the U.S. were preceded by this stark opportunity for citizens to finally see the truth of their countries. The founding of these two North American neighboring countries has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems. James Baldwin described this willful amnesia in the context of slavery and anti-black racism as a sinister crime, rendering white citizens ignorant of both self-knowledge and the systematic violence that they personally reinforce. Genocide and erasure are the origins and continued modes of operation of these countries. Clearing the land for white settlement was enacted by police and government officials through the deliberate spread of smallpox in British Columbia, for example. Railroads built by Chinese laborers, many of whom were indentured, forged paths for white settlers through the provinces and shore up the country. Starvation tactics were used in the prairies to thin indigenous populations, weaken resistance, force them onto reserves, and signed treaties in which the rights entitled to the land were officially extinguished. Erasure of indigenous presence through the Indian Act and reserve system, building cities and extractive resource projects over sacred homelands, sterilizing women and kidnapping children are just some examples of how this settler nation was built. After we shake off the emotional petrification and a spiritual shock, we recenter ourselves in understanding that not even horror writers can come up with something as sickening and culturally destructive as the realities the indigenous nations are coming to terms with now. And over recent years since TRC reports were published, Mohawk Tuscarora poet, media producer and artist Janet Rogers shares these notes. They say, the truth is more disgusting than fiction, and it was all brought here from over there. Indigenous voices are urgently asserting that colonial genocide and erasure are far from over. Although the schools, or as many are more accurately calling internment camps, officially closed in 1996, we continue to exist within a genocidal society superimposed upon indigenous homelands that targets women and children at unconscionable rates. Canada's aggressive institution of Indigenous youth genocide carries on to this day in the accelerated form of the foster care system that breaks apart Indigenous families and apprehends children at higher rates than residential schools, redistributing them in mostly non-Indigenous families and away from their communities. It also carries on in the federal government's refusal to cease discriminating against and violating the human rights of children by obstructing immediate access to health care and other needed resources, despite direct rulings by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal in 2016 and 19 non-compliance orders issued since then. The institution of genocide persists in the crushing ongoing crisis of Indigenous and especially Inuit youth suicide. If it were to happen in these overwhelming numbers in any non-Indigenous community in Canada, it would be considered an absolute emergency, states Inuk writer and performer Instuk Makri. This is an emergency and it is falling on unwilling hearts, unquote. Genocide persists in the racist Canadian healthcare system that enables widespread negligence and malpractice at the expense of Indigenous lives. It persists in the extinguishment clauses that remain central to modern-day treaties with federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It persists in governments' failure to officially recognize Indigenous languages or ensure access to fresh drinking water or adequate housing. It persists and a rampant systematic racism within the RCMP. This national police force was established in 1873 to suppress Indigenous peoples, forcibly settle and relocate people to reserves and other remote locations, enforce the Indian Act, and of course, kidnap Indigenous children. Genocide persists in the arrest and criminalization of indigenous land protectors enacting responsibilities to sources of life and the homelands. The historic erasure and fierce protection of institutionalized white crimes against humanity is finally coming to light. The callous failure to notify thousands of indigenous families of these deaths. Mass destruction of records. Continual withholding of records. Refusal to disclose names of perpetrators. The obstruction of any accountability or justice. Colonizers bury the truth of their horrific crimes with the bodies of the precious children in this land, in mass grave sites that were never meant to be found without gravestones, without ceremony, humanity, or remorse. At least in the earth, they could be held and in some way returned to creation. The deliberate effort to make these mass grave sites appear invisible, like an ordinary open field, is a perfect example of Canadian nationalism. Institutionalized racism and white supremacy have been so extensively normalized as to be invisible and even trivial to most Canadians. The ongoing violence and, yes, genocide that make way for Canadian authorities and non-Indigenous society to thrive are characteristically hidden, suppressed, denied, and simply ignored. Erasure of the truth is a practice of genocide, refusing to admit actual genocide by downplaying actions that the state not only instigated but continues to protect is a practice of genocide. These systems are in need of profound scrutiny and destabilization, as absence of remorse or accountability breeds only further promise of harm. As the Canadian government, RCMP, and churches abdicate responsibility and place the onus on each other to apologize, Indigenous voices are demanding that all of them, as well as the predators and murderers in official positions at these schools, be held to account for their crimes against humanity.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
August 31st, the end of the U.S. military presence on Afghan soil. The Taliban are celebrating what they're calling a victory and a good lesson for invaders. The two-decade-long U.S. military intervention in the country cost the lives of some 240,000 Afghans and 2,500 American troops, on top of the $2 trillion going down the drain. The U.S. and its allies already evacuated some 123,000 people from Kabul in a chaotic operation marred by explosions and deaths. Taliban are now boasting of what they are calling an independent Afghanistan that's for collaboration and interaction with the rest of the world. Let's start with a background report.
Celebratory gunfire across Kabul. Taliban fighters have marked what they called full independence of Afghanistan after the last U.S. troops left the country at dawn on Tuesday.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
The humiliation in Afghanistan was a legacy of four U.S. administrations. President George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan and toppled the then Taliban government after the 9/11 attacks. Washington had blamed the attacks on al-Qaeda terrorists based in Afghanistan. Bush's successor, Barack Obama, harshly criticized the invasion of Afghanistan. But his administration stuck almost with everything Bush's did. Obama maintained a major military presence in Afghanistan, frequently bombing the country with no regard for civilian lives. His administration boasted of key achievements in Afghanistan, including the training of a powerful national army. Then it was President Donald Trump's turn to stick to his election pledge on full withdrawal from Afghanistan. It took him almost his entire term in office to take the first step. It was a deal with the Taliban to pull all U.S. forces out by the end of April 2021. It came after long foot-dragging, and Trump pushed the ball in Joe Biden's court to actually act on his pledges. Biden finally took the plunge, pushing a chaotic full withdrawal in a matter of 2 weeks. It came after the Taliban ravaged the U.S.-touted Afghan army in a blitz 10-day campaign that left the group in almost full control of Afghanistan. The Afghan invasion was America's longest war. It killed an estimated 240,000 Afghans and nearly 2,500 U.S. troops. It also cost more than $2 trillion. But none of the objectives Bush had announced for the invasion were actually realized. Terror is yet to be eradicated in Afghanistan. That was also proved by the Daesh bombing that killed over 170 at Kabul airport last week. And at least a Western-style democracy was not established in Afghanistan either, which is obviously witnessed by the Taliban return to power after their government was toppled by the U.S.-led invasion of 2001. Biden only managed to put an end to the war by a hasty and humiliating exit, which some believe diminished the U.S. status as a superpower.
Now, welcome to this edition of The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. To discuss the U.S. Troop pullout, I will be joined today by member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, who is in Brussels. And co-director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, in New York. Good to have you both on the show. Now, let me ask Mick, no more U.S. Boots on Afghan soil. Did Washington manage to achieve its stated goals in Afghanistan?
Well, it was very hard to say what goal they had when they went in. It was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to 9/11. There was no Afghans involved in the 9/11 attack in America. There were 16 Saudis, and they didn't bombed Saudi because they were their friends, but they claimed they were bombing Afghanistan because they were harboring bin Laden, who was involved. So they went there supposedly to get bin Laden, but they obviously didn't get him in the early days, and it took them years to get him, but they obviously said they changed their mandate and what they were supposed to be doing there on several occasions. And at one stage, it was to get rid of the Taliban as well. But I mean, the Taliban disappeared at a very early stage because they didn't actually, it wasn't in their interest to stand and fight with them. It made a lot more sense just to retreat into the mountains from their point of view. And that's what they did. But the truth be told, I mean, we can discuss it in different aspects, but America achieved.
We'll come to that, sure. Now, Sarah, what do you think?
The only thing that America
Sarah, let me put this question to Sarah. Sarah, what do you think was the U.S. legacy in Afghanistan?
Well, I think in terms of the U.S. goal of having a strategic base in the region from which to threaten Iran and China and the small countries surrounding Russia, to have a position with hundreds of bases and forces in the region, it's an utter, complete failure, a disaster. There's no other way to put it. It achieved the goal always of the U.S. of endless profit to private military contractors, to the military and oil industries. Just billions of dollars literally disappeared into all sorts of offshore accounts. So in terms of military profit, a great for them a successful war, because even when they lose wars, they make lots of money. But in terms of the reputation, the standing of U.S. as a force in the region, trying to dominate the region. Remember, Afghanistan, also Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, all of these were targeted countries that the U.S. claimed that they would destroy, overcome, and dominate for the coming century, the political agenda of all countries. And they've shown that they completely failed, and against a country that is the poorest, the least developed. So this is a big achievement for any force in the world seeking to resist U.S. domination. It's a big achievement and a big failure for the U.S., as I see it.
Right. Now, Mick, this sure marks the end of the U.S. Military presence in Afghanistan. But is it also the end of the U.S. interference in Afghanistan's affairs?
I wouldn't believe that for a second. And the bases haven't disappeared, and the Americans will use them again, don't worry. The Americans have so-called, they've pulled out in terms of boots on the ground around the cities and countryside of Afghanistan. But if you think that Afghanistan has seen the last of America, I don't agree. Unfortunately, it'd be good if they would have seen the last of them by now. But I'd be very surprised if the Americans just disappear off the landscape from Afghanistan's point of view. And as the other speaker said, in terms of success of the mission, you could argue that the Americans' 20 years in Afghanistan was a great success, because they managed to give over $2 trillion to the military-industrial complex, which became the main target, not at the start, but it became that very soon after that. So from that point of view, it was a great success. The American people weren't complaining. The mainstream media helped just the lie, the narrative that was coming from Afghanistan. The mainstream media, not just in America, but also in Europe, bought into it. Oh, we're there for women's rights. We're there for the sake of the Afghan people. But in actual fact, they were only there to funnel over $2 trillion of U.S. taxpayers' money into the private sector. And it was a complete scam. The whole 20 years was a complete lie.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sarah, after the 2001 invasion, the U.S. Promised that it was trying to embark on nation-building efforts in Afghanistan. Did it succeed in the so-called nation-building efforts?
Well, I couldn't agree with Mick more. From the very beginning, it was a complete lie. There was absolutely no interest in democracy, nor was there any interest in the liberation of women. And that was very clear by the very reactionary and corrupt forces that the U.S. allied with from the very first day. They don't intend to leave Afghanistan now, because what they have put in place are sanctions that will deliberately create a famine, hyperinflation. They froze all of Afghanistan's money, outright theft, and froze IMF, World Bank, European Union, every conceivable penny going into Afghanistan. They proudly declared in their own publications that there's no medicine left in Afghanistan. That's how much they care for the people of Afghanistan. They declare that there is no food shipments coming in, and they made Afghanistan a completely dependent country. So Afghanistan right now will need the support of surrounding countries literally to survive this winter, because they were left penniless, and the freezing of every conceivable penny, the imposing of the sanctions on Afghanistan immediately, and then the drone attacks coming from Biden show what they're planning for the future. And those drone attacks, 7 children killed in one attack, we can see this is the future they want to have, but can they achieve it? I think we have seen the limitations of U.S. military high-tech equipment.
Now, let me put the same question to Mick. Mick, why did the U.S. nation-building mantra fail in Afghanistan?
Because they didn't even try to do it. They weren't interested in building any nation. As Sarah said, they couldn't care less about the people of Afghanistan, and they still couldn't care less about the people of Afghanistan. They reckon that there's twice as many people in poverty in Pakistan, in Afghanistan today, than there was in 2001. And God knows things weren't good in 2001. They have decimated the place. And from my perspective, what I find really nauseating is the role that the European Union and the European member states have played in supporting this American lie in Afghanistan for the 20 years. And now, after destroying the place, after creating hell for the people for 20 years, after holding them back from potential progress for those 20 years, now the Europeans are mostly worried about, are we going to get a flood of refugees trying to get into Europe? Well, given that we destroyed the place in the first place and helped to destroy the place, you'd think that we'd show some humanity, and for those that want to leave and want to come to Europe, the least we could do is actually accommodate.
Now, Sarah, the Taliban have been trying to ease fears that the rule this time around will be different from the one in late 1990s that was marked by, you know, massive amount of violence. Now, do you believe that the Taliban's rule this time will be any different?
Well, certainly, from what the Taliban has said, they want to normalize relations within Afghanistan and with the surrounding countries. And they well know that they desperately need peace and reconciliation. They have said there will be full pardons for everyone. We have no way of knowing. We have no crystal ball. We do know that the U.S. wants to destabilize and do everything they can that they fail in this effort. And that's what the drone attacks, that's what arming the remnant little ragtag forces inside Afghanistan mean. And that is what hyperinflation and shortages, all of that means. Can they set people against each other? That has been their strategy all along.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Taliban, these may be very different forces than 20 years ago, because leadership has again and again been decimated. But new forces have come forward, and that is always true in history. Movements change by circumstance, and in the end, everyone in Afghanistan overwhelmingly hated U.S. domination. So they were able to come together in this resistance in a surprising and in an overwhelming way. So let's see where this goes, but not believe any of the lies that are coming out now when the U.S. wrings its hands and talks about the Taliban being a terror force. The terror force in Afghanistan, no matter how you look at it, was U.S. military occupation. That really was a spread of terror, of imprisonment, of disappearances, of enormous corruption. That was terror, and at least that has been broken for now. So let's see where it goes, but I won't believe anything coming from the media here that they're concerned for the people of Afghanistan. They're not at all.
Okay. Now, Mick, let's take a look at another aspect. What about crimes that the U.S. Committed in Afghanistan? Just recently, and Sarah referred to this, we had this drone attack by the U.S. conducted on Monday. It left 10 Afghan civilians dead, including 7 kids. So will the U.S. ever be held accountable for such crimes committed in Afghanistan?
Sadly, international law doesn't apply to the likes of the U.S. For a long time now. And that's actually a big problem for the world. And it's a big problem for the European Union as well, that the Americans have no respect for international law. And I actually see the European Union disrespecting international law too in some matters now, especially in the area of sanctions, because all sanctions are illegal unless they are sanctioned by the UN. And what America is going to do to Afghanistan now in terms of sanctions, like it's doing to 39 other countries around the world at the moment, is illegal. Killing 7 children, and I noted today the High Representative of the European Union, Josep Borrell, he still hasn't condemned it. But they lost the plot when Navalny was thrown in prison in Moscow. He wasn't shot. He wasn't killed. His family wasn't killed. He was put in prison for what the Russians thought was because he breached Russian law. And the European Union went into a spin over it. And 7 children get illegally murdered by a U.S. drone, and we've nothing to say about it. We have a big problem with international law at the moment. But if you're asking me, are the Americans going to be held to account for things like this? In the short term, absolutely not, because they remain the strongest military force in the world. They have ignored international law for many, many, many years. Really, the Americans have shown very little respect for international law since the end of the Second World War. But I tell you what, the landscape is changing. And as Sarah says, Afghanistan's main concern will be getting on with its neighbors and getting on with Iran, Russia, China, will be crucial if Afghanistan is going to actually start a recovery of any form. Now, it's going to be very difficult, very, very difficult, because they're starting from a very difficult place. And on top of that, they're going to have the problem of U.S. sanctions, sadly, probably EU support for that. So it's a difficult place for Afghanistan at the moment. And they do need the support of the international community. But the chances of the Americans or the EU playing a positive role there are pretty slim.
Okay. Now, Sarah, what are the lessons that could be drawn from this U.S. troop pullout from Afghanistan after 2 decades?
Well, the first lesson, obviously, is don't go in. And U.S. out of everywhere, because 800 U.S. bases around the world, and all of them about destruction. and the focus now on the encirclement of China, and also just creating division everywhere they can. And it is true also using sanctions, 39 countries. That's a consciously starving down of countries, and it is completely criminally illegal by every standard and measure, by every moral, political, and international standard. So this is where the U.S. wants to head, wants to continue to head, but it is also true that the decay within the United States today, there's a hurricane, when there's a flood, when there's a fire, people are on their own. We have the highest death rate from COVID right here in the United States of any country in the world. Mm-hmm. We have no functioning healthcare system. So this is also the cost of $2 trillion to Afghanistan. It means it's stolen from what are human needs around the world and also right here in the United States. And they want to continue to do it. I think there's going to be a heavy accounting. And also, I do feel that the European collaborators are going to look twice at this and three times, wondering who they have hooked themselves to. It doesn't work in their interests, that's for sure. Right. And they were all for it while they thought they could go along for the ride and get easy pickings and be in on the take. But now they're finding out that it's cutting them out of a lot of the world and out of any kind of normalized relations. So we don't know the future with the Taliban at all or its political agenda, but we do know that there's a complete failure and collapse by the United States. Everyone can see this. Its allies can see it, its opponents, its collaborators, and it is in a weakened position. It still militarily has a terror organization, and it has enormous economic leverage to create pain by breaking sanctions, by breaking relations through sanctions. Mm-hmm. Will the people of the world begin to stand up and say, no, we're going to cooperate with each other. We're going to have normal trade and relations. We're not going to respect this illegal activity anymore. This is a big challenge, and I think it's a big moment of fundamental change.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels, and core director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, in New York, with our comments and insight. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
In the limelight.
Like the U.S. wars in Vietnam and Iraq, Bush invasion of Afghanistan was unlawful and led to the commission of torture and targeting of civilians, which constitute war crimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As Biden Threatens More War, Don't forget Afghanistan invasion was illegal. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States has lost the war it started illegally. But as U.S. troops leave Afghanistan, the Biden administration continues to kill and promises to persist in killing Afghan people. 20 years of the U.S. war and occupation in Afghanistan cost at least $2.26 trillion and resulted in the deaths of more than 2,300 Americans and tens of thousands of Afghan civilians. The so-called War on Terror George W. Bush launched with his Operation Enduring Freedom has included the torture and abuse of untold numbers of people in Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo, and the CIA black sites. It has exacerbated right-wing terrorism in the United States and provided the pretext for the surveillance of Muslims and those who dissent against government policy. And whistleblowers who expose U.S. war crimes have been rewarded with prosecutions under the Espionage Act and lengthy prison sentences. We must not forget the illegality, death, and destruction that the war in Afghanistan has caused over the decades, lest Americans repeat their lethal mistakes. Like the U.S. wars in Vietnam and Iraq, Bush's invasion of Afghanistan was unlawful and led to the commission of torture and targeting of civilians, which constitute war crimes. All three of those wars caused the deaths of thousands, even millions of people, cost trillions of U.S. taxpayer dollars, and devastated the countries of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The Bush administration began bombing Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, less than 1 month after the September 11, 2001, attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. As explained at the time, the U.S.-led NATO invasion of Afghanistan violated the United Nations Charter, which does not permit the use of military force for retaliation. The Charter mandates that countries settle their disputes peacefully using diplomatic means. But the United States repeatedly rejected diplomatic attempts at peaceful resolution. On October 15, 2001, the Washington Post reported, President Bush rejected an offer from Afghanistan's ruling Taliban to turn over suspected terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden to a neutral third country, as an 8-day of bombing made clear that military coercion, not diplomacy, remains the crux of U.S. policy toward the regime, unquote. The bombing of Afghanistan was not legitimate self-defense under the charter because of Afghanistan not attacking the United States on September 11, 2001. The 9/11 attacks were crimes against humanity, not armed attacks by another state. The hijackers were not even Afghans. 15 of the 19 men came from Saudi Arabia. Moreover, there was not an immediate threat of an armed attack on the U.S. after September 11th. Or the United States would not have waited nearly a month before initiating its bombing campaign. Although the Security Council had passed resolutions 1368 and 1373, neither authorized the use of force in Afghanistan. Those resolutions condemned the 9/11 attacks, ordered the freezing of assets, criminalized terrorist activity, mandated the prevention of terrorist attacks and the taking of necessary steps to prevent the commission of terrorist activity, including the sharing of information, and urged the ratification and enforcement of the international conventions against terrorism. The U.S. failure to commit to multilateralism, the cornerstone of international law at the heart of the U.N. Charter, is a fundamental flaw of U.S. policy in Afghanistan. Since the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court did not come into effect until 2002, the crimes against humanity perpetrated on 9/11 should have been prosecuted in domestic courts under the well-established doctrine of universal jurisdiction, which allows countries to prosecute foreign nationals for the most heinous of crimes. And the Security Council could have established a special tribunal for 9/11 attacks like it did in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. But the United States-led invasion of Afghanistan was illegal. The illegal invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and resultant war on terror led to the commission of war crimes, including torture and targeting civilians. Bush administration instituted a widespread program of torture and abuse. A 2014 report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence documented the use of waterboarding, which constitutes torture and other enhanced interrogation techniques. Detainees were slammed into walls, hung from the ceiling, kept in total darkness, deprived of sleep, sometimes with forced standing for up to 7.5 days, forced to stand on broken limbs for hours on end, threatened with mock execution, confined in a coffin-like box for 11 days, bathed in ice water, and dressed in diapers. On March 5, 2020, the International Criminal Court, ICC, ordered a formal investigation of U.S. and Taliban officials for war crimes, including torture, committed in the so-called War on Terror. The ICC prosecutor found reasonable grounds to believe that, pursuant to a U.S. policy, members of the CIA had committed war crimes. They included torture and cruel treatment and outrages upon personal dignity, rape, and other forms of sexual violence against people held in detention facilities in Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. During the Obama administration, prisoners held at Guantanamo were force-fed, which amounts to torture. Obama's use of drones to kill people in 7 different countries violated the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. Donald Trump conducted airstrikes in Iraq and Syria that killed record numbers of civilians, also in violation of the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. As Biden completes the withdrawal of troops in Afghanistan, his administration continues to kill people there. Nevertheless, on August 27th, Biden retaliated with a drone strike that apparently killed an ISIS-K planner, even though there was no evidence so far that he was involved in the suicide bombing near the airport recently. The U.S. Central Command released a statement that said, "We know of no civilian casualties from the U.S. drone strike, but according to The Guardian, an elder in Jalalabad reported that 3 civilians were killed and 4 were injured in the U.S. drone strike." The United States must completely refrain from using military force in Afghanistan.